So there's a lot of conflict in the world, whether at the level of nations going to war with each other, or civil war, as we see at the moment in the world, or even gang warfare, or even just neighbours quarrelling with each other. There's always been conflict among human beings. There's competition for resources, competition for sexual partners, struggles for power. There's just conflict between humans. And there's also conflict within each person, as it were, internal conflict. So there's external conflict and internal conflict. Fortunately for us, this conflict is not total. Yeah? It's restricted, it's restrained. It's restrained by what we call civilization. And there are, within human beings, tendencies towards cooperation and helpfulness as well as conflict. And, of course, on the individual level, there isn't just conflict. There also there's happiness and contentment and so on. Now, the reason there's conflict in the world and the reason there's conflict in individual human beings is because of greed, hatred, and spiritual ignorance and fear. And the reason there's cooperation and contentment in the world and in individuals is because there's spiritual aspiration. Spiritual aspiration is part of the makeup of human consciousness. And the spiritual aspiration carries with it a sense of moral values. So when we embark on the spiritual path, sometimes, perhaps quite often, we find ourselves in conflict with our immediate world, our own immediate world, by which I mean family and friends who perhaps think we're becoming strange or taking a wrong path or joining a cult or whatever. And we also experience internal conflict. Our budding, nascent spiritual aspirations come into conflict with our, what you may call, our lower nature. In other words, we want to love, for instance, but we discover ourselves hating. We want to be generous, but we experience greed. We aspire to courage and boldness, but we experience fear and insecurity. And when we take up meditation and embark on the spiritual path, not only do we experience these things, but we notice ourselves experiencing them. And we notice even more strongly than we did before, because we're becoming more aware. So the conflict, as it were, becomes more heightened. And I remember when I first got involved with Buddhism, and particularly when I first got involved with Sri Ratna, for the first 4 or 5 years, I'd say, I had a very strong aspiration to change, to become a bodhisattva, to help others, even to contribute to changing the world, to solving the problems of conflict in the world. But, of course, what I discovered, as probably many of you have discovered, is I discovered aspects of myself that were petty, angry, frightened, and altogether childish. And I went through periods of mental and emotional anguish, intense fear, depression, self-hatred, blaming others. And all the time, the spiritual aspiration was there. So I found myself to be a mess, a conflicted and unhappy mess. And this is, I know this is not just me because I've read about it in other people's biographies and so on. For instance, in his book, A Record of Awakening, David Smith describes a period of internal conflict that he suffered. And it was quite intense for him because he was doing a lot of intensive meditation at the time. and he says, the mind broke into two halves. One half, totally possessed by Mara, had nothing but hatred and contempt for me and my hypocrisy and impure practice. The other half tried to reason, defend, and contain this onslaught. Mara didn't let up. He tried with all his might and cunning to get me to let loose the tremendous power that consumed my whole being, battling the whole time with the part of me that brought forth insight, the part that says, don't react, just accept. The intensity just never let up. It really did take all my years of experience to keep myself contained. I could easily have fallen into the delusion that this creature came from outside of me, for it was quite happy to finish my life. But I never once saw it like that. The battle was always seen as a product of my own deluded mind. I felt cut open. With all these terrible thoughts coming up from the great depths of the subconscious, I felt very vulnerable and near to despair. So it seems that for some people, at least, the path to insight is, you could say it's paved with a crazy paving, a cracked and crazy paving, yeah? The paving of internal conflict, the paving of despair, depression, and things like that. In the Lalitavistra, there's description, there's a description of the lead up to the Buddha's enlightenment. So Mara's armies, Mara's daughters, and Mara himself appear and create as much disruption as possible. So these are personifications of the forces of hatred, craving, and ignorance. These are what constitute ego. So when we talk about our ego, it can sometimes get a bit abstract, as if we were talking about a thing, something within us that makes us behave selfishly or angrily. But there is no ego. There's no such thing. There is just spiritual ignorance, craving, ill will. And these are not things either. These are tendencies of our minds. They are activities of our minds, our speech and our bodies. You could say they're movements of energy. We are energy, and that energy flows through our thoughts, through our emotions, through our actions. So our thoughts, our emotions, and our actions are a flow of energy. And that flow of energy is what we are. And the spiritual life is all about giving a positive, helpful, cooperative, compassionate, wise direction to that flow of energy. And we're able to do that because we have self-awareness. We have aspiration towards higher values. That's part of what it means to be human. That's there. So awareness and spiritual aspiration are also energy. You could say energy in pursuit of the good, or what we call virya. And Padmasambhava, the great guru, the precious guru, personifies virya. So Padmasambhava, as far as we know, was an historical character living in the 8th century. But more importantly, he's become associated with a very rich symbolism. And it's a symbolism that deals very much with the conflict that arises in spiritual life. So symbolism, images, and myth are all crucial to understanding and practicing in a spiritual context. Spiritual practice needs to address or to move very deep subconscious energies. And these energies cannot be encapsulated in concepts or ideas or lists. The deeper energies manifest in dreams, in images, in visions, in mythic forms, and in the language and forms of symbolism and metaphor. So So in my own experience, when I experienced a lot of conflict, I found that my dreams were a key part of coming to a greater understanding and awareness of what was happening. As if the dreams were communicating, as it were, from a deeper level. And as the conflict subsided, after a few years, new images emerged in meditation. More peaceful, more expansive imagery. I remember at one point I could see quite clearly that it was as if I was two people, two different people, and they gradually came into dialogue and into an understanding of their mutual dependence. So this is just like a mythological story, like two characters, a mythological story of conflict and resolution. In the example I quoted earlier from David Smith, he goes on to say that he sees the forces of destruction as Mara, but he also personifies the Dharma. He says, "I've always had a wonderful relationship and rapport with the Dharma itself. I would talk to it, pray to it, and sometimes even curse it when I didn't get my own way. I always felt protected by it as it guided me so skillfully through each new situation and experience along the path. I always trusted that each new twist in my life, however unexpected, would work out okay, and so it always proved to be. Now I needed help like never before. I opened myself to the Dharma, bowed, and asked for help, and it came. It came in the form of the inner voice, the link between me and the Buddha." So he evokes the image of a guiding voice that helps him along the way from conflict to peace. In the case of the Buddha, Mara's armies are hideous and violent and turbulent. Mara's daughters are seductive and insinuating, and Mara is tempting and undermining. And all are highly symbolic of the powerful forces, the powerful energies aroused by spiritual practice. And in the case of the Buddha, resolution comes with the arising of the earth goddess and Brahma Sahumpati and Muchalinda. Even more powerful energies, but this time peaceful, cooperative, and helpful. So these powerful energies that are aroused by spiritual practice, both negative and positive, destructive and constructive, reactive and creative, these energies play a huge part in the symbolism and myth of Padmasambhava. So there are three major schools of Buddhism in Tibet. These three schools grew out of the particular emphasis in the teachings of three different teachers, three gurus. So these three founders were very different, and they're depicted very differently. Tsongkhapa, who founded the Gelug school, is in the dress of a scholar and appears with books, which are symbols of wisdom. Milarepa, the founder of the Kagyu school, is a naked yogi, deep in meditation and singing of the bliss of Shunyata. And Padmasambhava, who's the founder of the Nyingmapa school, he's richly dressed in different colored robes, carries a trident, a vajra, a bell, and he has many symbolic additions to his dress. And broadly speaking, the emphasis of the three schools is respectively on wisdom, meditation, and action. Padmasambhava, you could say, is the action man. Yeah? He's concerned with accessing and transforming the deep energies of the human psyche. So Padmasambhava is concerned with radical transformation. In fact, Buddhism, from the very beginning, was concerned with bringing about radical transformation in the individual human being. The Buddha seemed to have that effect on people. People who came into contact with him were often transformed. There's a passage in the Pali Canon that's often repeated by people who have an interaction with the Buddha which changes them, which transforms them. There's an example here. He says, "Then the Brahma, trembling, with his hair standing on end, went up to the Blessed One and fell with his head at his feet and said to the Blessed One, 'Wonderful Venerable Gotama, wonderful Venerable Gotama, just as, Venerable Gotama, one might set upright what has been overturned, or uncover what has been covered, or point out the way to one who had gone astray, or bring an oil lamp into the darkness, so that those with eyes might see shapes. In the same way, the doctrine has been declared by the Venerable Gotama in manifold ways.'" So some of this is an image of someone being radically transformed, shaken to his roots, trembling, hair standing on end. The image of setting upright what has been overturned is an image of complete change of direction. And this is the effect that the Buddha had on people, or could have on people. In later Mahayana Buddhism, this experience is spoken of as the parivritta, the turning about, which happens in the alaya vijnana, in the storehouse consciousness. And what this means is that all our volitional thoughts and words and actions, our kusala karma, our skillful actions, and our akusala karma, our unskillful actions, they're all deposited, so to speak, in the storehouse consciousness. Or to put it more simply, what we are now is the result of what we have been and what we have done. And if what we have done is skillful, the build-up of skillful karma eventually pushes out the effects of any previous unskillful karma. And when that happens, what is experienced is the turning about, the parivritta, in the storehouse consciousness. Suzuki, Japanese Buddhist, translates the storehouse consciousness, the alaya vijnana, as the deepest seat of consciousness. So you could say that the Yogacara, where this teaching comes from, is concerned to bring about this turning about, this parivritta, in the deepest seat of consciousness. Ordinary consciousness, mundane consciousness, is transformed into the wisdoms of the five Buddhas, the five jhanas. This is what the Vajra symbolizes as well, the transformation of the poisons of ordinary consciousness into the ambrosia of the five wisdoms. So when Padmasambhava wields the Vajra, he's holding reality. He's wielding the energy that arises when consciousness is integrated and transmuted. Padmasambhava went to the cremation ground to meditate. He sat on dried human bones or a corpse. There's an image actually on the back cover of the current Padmaloka program of a yogi meditating in a cremation ground, sitting on a corpse. And this is the kind of image that is evoked in the story of Padmasambhava, the image of a yogi meditation in a cremation ground. Actually, there's quite a lot about Padmasambhava in the current Padmaloka program, if you want to know more about Padmasambhava. So Padmasambhava, as I said, went to the cremation ground to meditate. He sat on dried human bones. He encountered his deepest fears. And he encountered all the powerful forces of the subconscious mind. In the Life and Liberation of Padmasambhava, there's a section referring to this. It goes like this. "There to be seen were countless dakinis. Some of them have eyes that dart out sun rays. Others give rise to thunderclaps and ride water buffaloes. Others hold sabers and have eyes which inflict harm. Others wear death's heads, one above the other, and ride tigers. Others wear corpses and ride lions. Others eat entrails and ride garudas. Others have flaming lances and ride jackals. Others, five-faced, are steeped in a lake of blood. Others in the numberless bands carry many generations of living beings. Others carry in their hands their own heads, which they have severed. Others carry in their hands their own hearts, which they have torn out. There are others who have made gaping wounds in their own bodies, and who empty out and devour their own intestines and entrails. So I won't carry on with that. You get the idea. It's evoking all that's fearful, all that's, in a way, monstrous, all that's perhaps the deepest fears you encounter when you're in a situation like that, whatever a situation like that is, meditating on the formation ground. So the dakinis, you could say, are the primordial energies of the mind, which have to be integrated into the conscious mind. Natural forces that have to be transformed, even tamed, so that they are supporting spiritual practice rather than in conflict with it. I was thinking about this, that just like if you're familiar with the images of the five jinnas, the five Buddhas, you'll notice that there are animals supporting the lotuses. In a way, this is similar imagery. It's about the forces, the deep natural forces that are being transformed so that they're supporting spiritual practice, supporting insight into the transcendental. So they're not energies that should be, not forces that should be crushed or cast out into the night, because without them, spiritual practice would be anemic, it would be bloodless, dull, stagnant. So they're not to be destroyed. They're to be transformed. So when these energies are integrated, when they're transformed, our spiritual practice takes flight. There's energy, there's direction, there's courage, there's joy and abundance. The dakinis dance naked through the sky, uninhibited by egoistic boundaries and anxieties, abandoned to the great play of the bodhisattva's compassionate activity. But how are these energies integrated? How do the dakinis become friends and protectors instead of disruptive forces of nature? Dramatic pause. But first of all, we have to meet the dakinis. Yeah? So Padmasambhava meets the dakinis by meditating in cremation grounds. Cremation grounds were terrible places for ordinary people, inhabited by ghosts and ghouls and everything fearful, especially at night and especially when you're alone. So you meet the dakinis in the places, or perhaps better to say, on the occasions when you're alone with the things that cause you fear and anxiety. When your sense of insecurity is at its greatest. Especially when you have no choice but to go through with whatever it is you fear. When you can't back out. When you have to face your fear. Then this tremendous energy is released. And you find you can do things you were convinced you could never do. Now, for some people, simply being alone is enough. For instance, on a solitary retreat. Actually, somebody told me recently that they had to work with fear for a whole 2 weeks of being on solitary retreat. And that's what sitting in the cremation ground means. For others, the cremation ground is what Bhante calls the crucial situation. So the crucial situation will be different for different people. It might be giving a talk or presentation. That might be the thing you fear. Or traveling alone in a country where you don't speak the language. Or doing something that your parents or family disapprove of. For example, going on retreat at Christmas. Or speaking up, even though you know you will be criticized. Or showing your artwork publicly, or singing a solo, whatever it is. It is almost any situation in which you fear failure and you fear humiliation. It's that fear of failure, that fear of humiliation, that's when we start to experience in a very tangible form what that abstract idea of ego is trying to get at. Yeah? So there are more crucial situations than there are people. And it's in these crucial situations, in these cremation grounds, that we encounter the dakinis, these energies, these primordial forces that can either paralyze us with fear or that can lift us to heights we never thought possible. The dakinis live on the other side of the wall erected by our fears and anxieties and insecurities. And as the dakini energies are integrated, we find confidence and a free flow of energy. So later on in the career of Padmasambhava, this was early in his spiritual practice, he was meditating in cremation grounds. Later on, he's invited to Tibet by King Trisong Detsen, who wants to re-establish the Dharma there. Now, the great scholar Shantarakshita had already been to Tibet to teach the Dharma. But what it says in the text is that his efforts were opposed by the local gods and demons. So why did the local gods and demons oppose Shantarakshita? What did he do to upset them? But it seems that what he did was ignore them. He didn't even notice them. He was unaware of their existence. So who or what were the gods and demons of Tibet? And what, if anything, is their relevance to us here in civilized, cultured, well-mannered Cambridge in 2013? Yeah? The gods and demons are the non-rational forces at work in each individual and in society as a whole. Shantarakshita went to Tibet. By the way, it's Shantarakshita, not Sangharakshita, just in case you're confused. Shantarakshita went to Tibet and set to work laying out the principles of the Dharma. He taught the 10 precepts, the 18 elements of the perceptual situation, the 12 nidanas. He systematically taught Buddhist ethics, philosophy, metaphysics. And when he was asked by the king, "What is your doctrine?" he replied quite straightforwardly, "My doctrine is to follow whatever is proved correct after examining it by reason and to avoid all that does not agree with reason." So his approach was quite rational, almost scientific, logical. But apparently, I get this from Bhante, apparently he didn't teach meditation. He didn't introduce ritual. He ignored the deeper forces at work, the non-rational, emotional energies that constantly bubble away beneath the surface of the rational and the well-mannered. But Padmasambhava, having passed through the cremation grounds and danced with the dakinis, had a different approach. He was very aware of the local gods and demons and set about subduing them so that they would become protectors of the Dharma rather than opponents. And in this, Padmasambhava was successful. And then Shantarakshita was able to return to Tibet, and together they worked to build Samye Monastery and to establish Buddhism in Tibet. The rational and the non-rational approaches worked together in harmony, and gradually out of their efforts, a spiritual community is founded. So in our own situation, we have to appeal to both the rational and the non-rational of ourselves and others. Rationally, we understand the precepts and we aspire to be good people and good Buddhists. We know the importance of mindfulness and metta. We know the importance of regular meditation, of retreats, of spiritual friendship. We know a lot of things, We know what the best conditions for spiritual practice are. We know so much, and we know it very thoroughly. We study it, we discuss it, we explore it, we reflect on it. And in spite of all that, we continue to be unmindful, to harbour ill will, to distract ourselves with all sorts of rubbish, to miss meditation, to neglect friendships, and to deliberately put ourselves in conditions that are not conducive to spiritual practice. We continue to crave satisfaction from all the wrong things. We continue to be deluded. It's as if there are gremlins in the works, little demons, yeah? We know what's right, and perversely, we do the opposite. Our demons are at work. Mara is playing with us, or to put it more conceptually, we have not yet found the emotional equivalence for our intellectual understandings. That's how Bhante puts it. And all our spiritual practice is to help us to find these emotional equivalents. Our responses to puja and to symbolism, story, myth and metaphor all play a part in gradually transforming our intransigent Mara nature into a heartfelt faith and energy that enables us to follow our spiritual aspirations without great conflict and distraction. But in order to find this level of emotional integrity and wholeness, we have to be willing to fearlessly face our demons. We need to get to know our little demons and acknowledge them as ours. We need to be aware of and recognize our own insecurity, our own fear, our own craving, our own ill will, our own ignorance. We need to be able to accept our imperfect state, our perversity. So, to put it simply, we need to own our mental states and our moods as our own and not blame others or situations for our state of mind. So, the shops with all their wonderful array of goods, etc., might be designed to give rise to craving, but the craving is ours and we need to take responsibility for it. Our craving for gadgets is not engendered by Apple or Samsung. They just tap into what is already there. It's not Next or John Lewis or whatever your favourite place happens to be that causes craving. They just use it. It's not our colleagues at work or our other road users that cause our ill will or our anger. They just provide opportunities for it. So we need to learn to see our demons, get to know them thoroughly, and through that awareness, we will begin to transform them. And of course, in order to be able to look the demons in the eye and acknowledge them as ours, we need to love ourselves, demons and all. Now, because individual human beings are unawakened and subject to craving and hatred, because this is what unenlightened consciousness is like, it follows that human societies are pervaded and permeated by these demons too. And because we're dealing with deep, irrational energies, not under the control of reason, it follows that all human societies will be affected by undercurrents of greed and hatred and delusion. And from time to time, these undercurrents will burst out in explosions of energy that shakes society to its core. This is what war is. This is what economic meltdown is. This is religious fanaticism. mass hysteria of one kind or another. It's those forces breaking up, breaking surface, breaking through the veneer of civilization. So I want to just look at one of these, as it were, external demons, demons of our society. A demon that resides here, even here in quiet, civilized, well-known Cambridge. Yeah? Now, I'm sure there are many demons in Cambridge, but I just want to look at one many-headed monster. In the story of Padmasambhava, he encounters a monstrous character who's known as Black Salvation and also as Matarangara, which means the one who devours his own mother. And the depiction of this character, Matarangara, is a description of everything that is repulsive and revolting and monstrous. And it's a symbolic way of saying that samsara is repulsive and monstrous. It is a way of saying that what we have to overcome on the way to spiritual awakening is something that has tremendous power and energy and fills our world, a huge, monstrous presence. There's a talk by Bhante Sangharakshita where he reads out a very long description of Matarangara, or Black Salvation. It's if you're interested, it's talk number 151. It's called Padmasambhava Day 1979. It's well worth listening to. So for our society, I think the great monster is what is known as consumerism, or progress through consumer-led growth. Now, when I say consumerism, I don't mean shopping. Shopping is just part of it. Why is consumerism monstrous? Why is it a Matarangara, one who devours his mother? Our whole world is based on a view, a philosophy even. And this view manifests as an accepted way of life. And this accepted view and accepted way of life exerts a powerful influence on all of us. It is all around us. It pervades and permeates our whole world. And it's so ever-present that we cannot see its influence sometimes. It reaches into the depths of our emotional and subconscious life. So for many people, for perhaps the vast majority of people, this view, this philosophy is so self-evidently true that it's not possible to conceive of another view or another way of being. And this view, put very simply, is that happiness and fulfillment are a product of economic well-being. Your security, your contentment, is dependent on the possession of a sufficient amount of money and goods. And this view expands and expands and expands. As our irrational minds, as it were, engage with this view, our natural craving assumes that greater happiness and greater fulfillment is achieved by a steady accumulation of money and possessions. Also, there are many offshoots of this view, such as the view that choice is a supreme good. And having choice is the equivalent of freedom. And the more choice we have, the more freedom we have. And another head, as it were, of this many-headed monster says that everything is something to be purchased and appropriated. Whether it's a smartphone, an overcoat, a car, or meditation, yoga, Buddhism, it's all something we can accumulate and possess, something we can own. And individualism is also a part of the logic of consumerism. Individualism leads us to consider ourselves as somehow separate from and unconnected to others. Consumerism also encourages narcissism, to see everything in terms of how it affects me, and all that self-centeredness and vanity that goes with that. So in the culture of consumerism, we are consumers before we are anything else. before we are citizens or family members or adherents of a religious doctrine, above all that, we are consumers. That's our identity. And if we refuse that identity, we will find ourselves pitted against the many-headed monster, the Hydra. In Greek mythology, when there's a many-headed monster called Hydra, when one of the heads of the Hydra is cut off, two more grow in its place. So that would suggest that in encountering the many-headed demon of consumerism, we need a more subtle and intelligent approach. Cutting off heads that regrow doubly is no solution. So in the work of overcoming the demons of the mind and the demons of the marketplace, we need intelligence and awareness and love. Intelligence shows us how to be skillful, how to create the conditions that give us the most advantageous position. If you want to grow flowers, you have to plant flower seeds and tend them. If you want to grow wisdom and compassion, you have to plant the seeds of wisdom and compassion and tend them. Awareness helps us to see the demons around us and within us, and the light of that awareness starts to transform the demons, and love, or metta, is the context in which the whole drama can play out to a satisfactory conclusion. So if we're not to be swamped by the consumerist culture that surrounds us and forms the ideological basis of our whole society, then we need to be alert. We need to be aware of how the influence of consumerism is being exerted on us continuously. We need to be aware of what that influence leads us to experience, to feel, and to do. We need to see and acknowledge the ways in which we are deeply affected by consumerist attitudes and assumptions. They affect the way we relate to each other, the way we relate to the environment around us, the world around us. They affect our ideas of freedom. They affect our ideas of progress. They affect our ideas of happiness and fulfillment. Everything that we think of is affected by this kind of ideological basis of society. So we need to see and acknowledge, as I said, the ways in which we're deeply affected by consumerist attitudes and assumptions. So denying that we are influenced in this way could hold us back, unless we really are above it all and on a different level of consciousness. As always in the spiritual life, it's essential that we are honest with ourselves. And we need to find intelligent ways of gently diluting those attitudes and assumptions and leading ourselves in a more positive, expansive, and compassionate direction. Skillfulness of all kinds is the way to tend the seeds of awakening and compassion. And the context of kindness or metta is supremely important because it helps us not to polarize with all the aspects of ourselves and our society that are symbolized by the demons. Padmasambhava does not destroy the demons and gods of Tibet. He subdues them and transforms them into protectors of the Dharma. He does not destroy the deep irrational forces of the subconscious. He transforms them into allies. Our task is not to destroy the deep irrational forces of our own nature or of our society. It's to transform them. When I was thinking about this, I was trying to think of parallels in Western mythology. And it's interesting to note that in Western mythology, the monster is usually killed. St. George kills the dragon. Hercules slays the Hydra. Beowulf kills the monster Grendel and his mother. Even in the film Jaws, the hero Brody kills the shark, and so on through science fictions and westerns and whatever. The monster is killed. I couldn't think of a Western myth in which the monster is subdued and changes sides, so to speak. Possibly Beauty and the Beast might be interpreted in that way, but I don't think so. Now, that might show how Buddhism is very different to the underlying currents of Western culture, which are cast in a much more polarized form of good versus evil, God versus Satan, rationalism versus the irrational, hero versus villain. The underlying current of Buddhism is that no one is beyond redemption. All have the potential to awaken. And this is seen in how the Buddha never tries to destroy Mara. It is seen in the conversion of Mara's daughters in the Vimalakirti Nidesha. And it's seen in the subduing of the demons and gods of Tibet by Padmasambhava, and in all the symbolism associated with Padmasambhava. You could say Padmasambhava is a figure of great optimism and joy. He's the one who shows that no dark forces of the mind or the world are irredeemable. He's the one who shows that if we face our fears, if we face our fears and insecurities, if we face our greed and ill will, if we face our own ignorance and delusions and acknowledge them as our own, we can become free. We can become free from them and experience the liberation of the sky dancers, the uninhibited freedom of the Dakini consciousness. Padmasambhava comes to us via Bhante Sangharakshita. Bhante's first encounter with Padmasambhava was in a Tibetan gompa or temple in Darjeeling. And he writes about it in his memoirs, the volume entitled Facing Mount Kanchenjunga. He says, "I had never seen an image of Padmasambhava before, perhaps not even a painting. As I entered the temple, all the greater was my shock, therefore, when I saw in front of me, three or four times larger than life, the mighty, sedent figure of the semi-legendary founder and inspirer of the Nyingmapa tradition, a skull cap in his left hand, a staff topped with skulls in the crook of his left arm, and the celebrated, wrathful smile on his moustached face. All this I took in instantly, together with the lotus hat, the richly embroidered robes, and the much smaller flanking figures of his two consorts, one Tibetan and one Nepalese. Having taken it in, I felt that it had always been there, and that in seeing the figure of Padmasambhava, I had become conscious of a spiritual presence that had in fact been with me all the time. Though I had never seen the figure of Padmasambhava before, it was familiar to me in a way that no other figure on earth was familiar. Familiar and fascinating. It was as familiar as my own self, yet at the same time infinitely mysterious, wonderful and inspiring. Familiar, mysterious, wonderful and inspiring it was to remain. Indeed, from then on, the figure of the precious Guru, Guru Rinpoche, was to occupy a permanent place in my inner spiritual world, even as it played a prominent part in the spiritual life and imagination of the entire Himalayan region." Later on, Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche asked Kachu Rinpoche to give Bhante the initiation into the Padmasambhava sadhana. And that ceremony took place in Kalimpong, in Bhante's vihara in Kalimpong, and it lasted 2 days. In fact, he says he didn't really know what was going on. He just sat there and absorbed it and let it all flow over him. So Padmasambhava has been a huge influence in Bhante's spiritual life. And being a big influence in Bhante's life, Padmasambhava has come to be a tremendous influence in the life of the Triratna order and community. the teachings about the cremation grounds, subduing demons, and lots of other elements of tantric practice have been translated by Bhante into forms that are useful and effective for us in leading our spiritual lives. And it's just for us to open ourselves to their message. It is up to us to face our demons, to recognize our cremation grounds, to free our energy for the radical transformation that comes about if we allow Padmasambhava and all that he symbolizes to touch our lives. That's it. Thank you.